Good morning. I'm going to talk about how we implemented a cocooning strategy against pertussis in a high-risk population in a project that is administered by the Center for Vaccine Awareness at Texas Children's Hospital, and it's administered to families who deliver their infants at Bentov General Hospital in Houston, Texas. These are my disclosures, and Sanofi Pasteur donate vaccine for this program. So, as Brady has already alluded to, the incidence of pertussis is up to 20-fold higher in infants who are too young to have completed the primary immunization series at 2, 4, and 6 months of age. And pertussis-related complications and deaths occur almost exclusively in this particular age group. Another interesting fact about the epidemiology is that infants of Hispanic ethnicity are overrepresented both in pertussis incidence, which is up to 74% higher, and in pertussis-related deaths. As a matter of fact, 70% of pertussis-related deaths in the US in 2007 were in infants of Hispanic ethnicity. And we know that over 75% of pertussis-infected infants acquire the infection from a household contact, about a third from their mother, which is really not surprising given that the mother is the main caregiver. So, driven by these data, in 2006, ACIP recommended Tdap booster immunization of infant caregivers in the targeted immunization strategy known as cocooning. Under cocooning, there are three specific target groups. First, postpartum women who should be immunized before they're discharged from the hospital with their infant. All contacts of infants who are less than 1 year of age, and all healthcare providers of infants less than 1 year of age. The latter group being predominantly targeted by occupational health programs. However, cocooning has proven very challenging to implement. Not least because it's a new immunization platform for which there's no pre-existing infrastructure. For it to work, it requires raising pertussis awareness amongst healthcare providers and amongst the general population. It focuses really on two new populations, which are postpartum women and the families of newborn infants. And it brings in a whole lot of new immunization providers who are not traditional vaccinators. And again, last but not least, there are significant reimbursement issues. There are significant issues both with vaccine procurement and vaccine administration, and who's going to pay for that? So our objectives with this program are first to raise pertussis awareness by educating healthcare providers and the families of newborn infants about the potential for life-threatening pertussis in those infants. We then aim to have a phased implementation of cocooning in a high-risk, predominantly Hispanic, medically underserved, and uninsured population in Houston, Texas. Phase one was the implementation of postpartum immunization, and then in phase two, we expanded to immunizing household contacts of newborn infants on the floor of the hospital before the infant was discharged. And finally, we aim to identify potential barriers in implementing this targeted immunization strategy. So awareness was raised among healthcare providers by grand rounds and by small group in-service sessions. We targeted obstetricians and family practitioners, midwives, and particularly nursing personnel, because not only are they trusted advisors for new parents in the first few days of life, but we felt that they could really be very powerful vaccine advocates. Because of the nature of our population, who are predominantly Spanish-speaking only, we also targeted translators very strongly. We displayed posters and literature about the program prominently in antenatal and postnatal areas. And each family who delivered an infant gets a pertussis information packet, which not only gives information on the disease, but also gives them information on other means by which they can access low or no-cost vaccines for themselves or for friends. And finally, someone from this program is available either in person or by phone to answer questions on a 24/7 basis, and that's how it's been since January 2008. So under phase one, starting in January 2008, a standing order for postpartum Tdap has become standard of care in Bentop Hospital, unless there's a maternal contraindication is present. Now, initially, we observed the two-year minimum interval from a prior tetanus-containing vaccine, as had originally been voted on by ACIP, and which is still in the ACOG statement. However, since June of 2009, following the publication of the MMWR pregnancy and postpartum statement, we have not required a minimum interval. And that's in line with the increased latitude that is in the advice being given out by the CDC. Tdap is administered on hospital discharge at a time when rubella vaccine is also administered if it's needed. And we record both maternal demographics and the reasons for Tdap refusal if they're available. During phase two, which started in June 2009, we also offer Tdap to contacts of newborn infants. Wherever possible, a nurse from our program will interview postpartum women to ascertain the number of additional contacts in the family who are eligible for and recommended to receive Tdap. We provide pertussis education to families, and then consenting eligible contacts are immunized. Where possible, we take the demographics of vaccinees and their likely degree of infant contact. So under this program, over 150 healthcare providers have completed pertussis in service, which is repeated at regular intervals. And since January 7th, 2008, through the January 31st of this year, 8,138 of 11,174 postpartum women, 73% in total, had received Tdap prior to hospital discharge. They had a median age of 27 years, 92% were of Hispanic ethnicity. And previously, we've reported that in the first 4 months of this project, when we excluded women who had had a recent tetanus and who believed themselves to be ineligible for vaccine, we had an acceptance rate of 96.2%, with a threefold higher refusal rate in Black women. So if we focus on the time period from June 2009, January 2010, which as you remember is when we did away with the two-year rule, and we have immunized 2,969 of 3,455 mothers, that's 86% Tdap within that time period. Now, a further 197, or 6% of women, had documented previous Tdap administration, the vast majority of whom had been immunized by our program with the birth of a previous baby. Their demographics were similar to the overall cohort. And not surprisingly, the vast majority were aged between 20 and 30, over 50%. But if I could just draw your attention to this group here, the group who are aged 10 to 19 years. And this is an important group, not only because in outbreak studies from the 1990s, infants of mothers less than age 20 were known to be at higher risk of developing pertussis, but also, probably more importantly, this is a group who should have been targeted already by the adolescent platform. Not only this, but Tdap vaccine is now required for middle school entry in the state of Texas. Now, this is a recent recommendation, but we will be watching to see if this affects our uptake in this group. And the final point is that this is a group for whom the normal financial constraints do not apply, because they're all eligible for the vaccines for children. When we looked at the mothers that we had who were immunized or not immunized, there was no difference in terms of their age. However, once again, we did find that a higher proportion of Black women were not immunized compared with those who were. That was 11% to 5.3%, and this was statistically significant. Some of the non-medical reasons why Tdap was not given included a history of previous local reaction to vaccines, intercurrent illnesses or underlying medical conditions that were not contraindications, and a couple of people who had religious objections. So next, if I've having focused on the easy bit, let me talk about phase two, which is moving to immunizing other infant contacts. So during the time period that I've talked about, June 2009 through January 2010, we interviewed 2,303, or 67% of mothers who delivered. Through those interviews, we identified that there were a median of 4 additional household contacts, a range of 1 to 15, of whom a median of 3 were eligible for Tdap, either by age, previous immunization history, or medical history. And out of that, we immunized a median of 2 contacts per family interviewed. 58% of families had more than one or more additional contact immunized. And in total, we immunized 1,860 contacts. Only one came back to report an adverse event. This was gastroenteritis, which we felt was unrelated to Tdap administration. And also of note, 55% had no idea when their last tetanus shot was and could not even narrow it down to a 2-year window. 91% of the contacts we immunized were immunized either before or on the day of the infant discharge. A further 8% received their vaccination within a week of the infant discharge when they returned to the hospital for an infant checkup. And 95% were of Hispanic ethnicity. Again, when we look at the age, there was a wide age range. Again, 7% fell within the adolescent platform, who should have been got elsewhere, but weren't. And when we looked at the contact relationship to the infants, 87% actually resided in the same household. 2/3 were fathers, and then there were smaller proportions who were grandmothers and aunts who might in this population be expected to be prominent caregivers for the infant. In all, 98% of those we immunized reported at least daily contact with the infant, and 63% anticipated that they would be in contact with the infant for periods of greater than 12 hours of the day. So next we looked at how many complete infant cocoons that we had done, because this is a very challenging strategy, as I've already said. And in 26% of cases, we immunized 100% of people who were likely to be in contact with an individual infant. However, our mean was nearer 58% and our median was 50%. I think that this just shows just how challenging this is to implement. One of the other points is that once we expanded our program, this coincided very much with the H1N1 2009 pandemic. And in the fall of 2009, in line with the second wave of cases that arose in Houston, the hospital instituted some pretty restricted visiting practices. So there's one designated visitor for the mother and baby pair for the entire duration of the hospitalization. Just one. And that person cannot be changed. And these restrictions were actually only relaxed 2 weeks ago. And then they did allow additional contacts to the floor to get their Tdap vaccine. But during that time period, they were not allowed to see either mother or baby. And this was strictly enforced. And I think you can agree that that's not much of an inducement to leave your job, come to the hospital and get your shot. And not surprisingly, it did have an effect on our Tdap uptake. Somewhat surprisingly, our uptake of vaccine among mothers increased 5%, whether this is because healthcare providers or mothers themselves were more pro-vaccine, it's very difficult to say. But the percentage of fathers who were immunized decreased to 9%. The percentage of families where one or more contact was immunized decreased 11%. And the number of complete cocoons went from 28% to 23%. And these were all statistically significant. So in conclusion, Our postpartum immunization program against pertussis was successfully implemented through a standing order protocol, with our Tdap uptake increasing 17% when we eliminated the requirement for a 2-year interval from the previous tetanus. Tdap immunization was, I think, very well accepted by this cohort of mothers and families whose infants are at particularly high risk of acquiring pertussis because of their ethnicity and their underinsured status. And the H1N1 pandemic negatively impacted the implementation of cocooning. We've identified a number of barriers to the full implementation of cocooning, and these include the need for a convenient out-of-hours service. We, at the time of this study, we had a 5-day, 8-to-5 service. We need to be there when families visit, which is late in the evenings and which is on weekends. We need accurate, easily accessible immunization records. This is only going to become more important with time. And we need targeted education strategies. And finally, I think that cocooning really requires a multifaceted, multidisciplinary approach to be successfully implemented. And the necessary infrastructure and education will require both investment of finances and investment of time. And finally, I'd just like to acknowledge my friends and colleagues, because this was multiple efforts from multiple people. I'd like to especially thank Carl Baker, and I'd like to thank Baylor Methodist Community Health Fund and Harris County Hospital District Foundation, who gave us funding to start this program, Sanofi Pasteur, who donated us a vaccine, and all our healthcare practitioners. And if I can just show you this man, he has the distinction of being the 10,000th person immunized under this program on February 1st of this year. And in doing so, he completed his own personal family cocoon, which will hopefully protect his newborn twins from getting pertussis. Thank you.
Thanks to all the speakers. You're welcome to ask questions now. Please step to the microphone and identify yourself. Thank you.
Questions? Yes, my name is Richard Judelson. I'm a medical director and a pediatrician in Buffalo, New York, and we have just implemented a cocooning program in all of our birthing hospitals. And the major barrier that took us so long to get to 2010 was financial. So what happens here when the Sanofi Pasteur Adacel runs out?
Well, I've been very fortunate because I anticipated that we would run out sometime within the next 6 months. So I went back to Sanofi and asked them for more, and they've given me more. So I'd like to thank them very much for that. I think that this is something that is underestimated when people are talking about cocooning. There's all this talk that there's stimulus funds that are available to implement cocooning. Nobody has a long-term plan. It isn't currently, I'm not sure about every other state, but currently in the state of Texas, Medicaid does not cover, it's not bundled within the Medicaid payments that mothers get. And the vast majority of hospitals, to my understanding, have not negotiated that Tdap be included within even their postpartum care. So this is, I'm not sure how to fix this, but this is something that I think needs to be addressed at a higher level than just for us. As I say, I've been fortunate in that I go cap in hand to Sanofi, and so far they've been pretty generous.
Thank you.
Vitaly Pouls, Sanofi Pasteur. I have a question for Linda. In your survey, I'm wondering if you asked questions about the impact of the symptoms on daily life, or did you ask questions whether you missed work or school, just to estimate the burden of the disease on the social and work life of these students?
We had open-ended questions on that and got a fair amount of comment, just spontaneous comment about people being sick 3 months later and it impacting them as far as work and school. We did not have a specific question that itemized potential effects.
This is for the Baylor study. We all know that African Americans are harder at times to vaccinate. Did you, since your percentages were higher for refusals, did you go any further in depth to find out why these pregnant moms refused?
You know, this is one of the difficult things, because this is not just African Americans, these are African immigrants as well. Because in the hospital demographics, they're just registered as black. So, but I can tell you, just looking at the names and just from being in the hospital, the refusal was both in African Americans and in Africans. I'm not sure exactly why this happens. I know that it has been noted in other studies. I think that maybe we just need to look at our educational initiatives and see if we need to communicate the message better to African Americans and to African immigrants. You know, but we haven't had the opportunity to look at that in depth yet. We intend to.
Mary, one comment and one question. The comment is that Houston has the largest Nigerian population outside of Nigeria. So a lot of our African-American assignees are actually African immigrants. My question is, we certainly appreciate the donation of vaccine, which was worth a lot of money to the program, and that needs to be addressed by all the states that want to do Cocoon so that it's added to Medicaid or whatever. But the question for you is, how many dollars were spent in time? Because none of this, except for the immunization, was done by the hospital nurses. Can you give us an estimate of the amount of money spent on implementing phase one and phase two? And I hope your math is better than mine.
Okay, I can just deal in percentages, and I'm glad that you asked that, because I realized that I hadn't really brought that up. In terms of, so we have one nurse who works 100% of her time in the hospital administering the vaccine to family members. We have another part-time nurse who probably works about 30 to 40% of her time since February, who fills in those days when we allow Betsy, our main nurse, take some time off. We have an additional nurse who helps maintain our database and check on vaccination history. She spends about 25% of her time doing this. I would estimate that I spend 20 to 30% of my time, and have done so since January 2008, or even before that in the planning phases, on this project, for which I have not been reimbursed. So this is something that is very, very costly to implement. For it to work properly, you need to have dedicated staff and you need to have dedicated time. It's not enough just to say, do a standing order, because then you're just setting yourself up for failure.
I have a couple questions. One being that as far as your cocooning, you have implemented receiving the vaccination for postpartum women in the hospital. Have you worked with a partnership with the OB offices that are local for when they go for their 6-week follow-up for them too? The ones that have declined and may have done so because they weren't really understanding so, and catching those ones that declined with the enhancement of the provider, since the following speaker said, you know, if a provider recommends it, most oftentimes they will agree to get it. So catching those that have missed the opportunity.
That's a good question. In our particular population, they're predominantly undocumented. They don't access care, so follow-up is not always assured. I think that certainly you can look at doing the 2-week checkup and the 6-week checkup as other times to catch people that you've missed in the hospital. However, that's probably too late for a whole lot of infants. Ideally, if you're going to expand cocooning, you should be immunizing people before the baby is born, everyone except the mother. That's not practical, again, in this population, because they don't turn up for antenatal visits. And even if the mom has access care, in this population, the dads and the rest of the family members are working. They don't go with the mom. And I think that from our standpoint, our best chance of getting them to accept it is while the baby is captive in the hospital. I think once they go home, it becomes less of a priority for them, and they become less scared of what's going to happen to the baby. So it's a little bit of emotional manipulation. But you are right. I mean, for it to work, we need to look at using alternative sites, and we need to look at immunizing people whenever we come across contacts. However, if you're going to focus your efforts predominantly on doing that after the baby is born, that's going to be a lot too late for a lot of the babies who have the highest risk of complications and mortality from pertussis.
Now, you also had mentioned as far as family members going and being able to get vaccinated, who ended up paying for those vaccinations for those family members or close contact of the infants when they went to the hospital setting?
Again, this is all through donations from charitable foundations, which is how our nurse has been employed, and our nurses are the people who administer vaccinations, and through the donated vaccine from Sanofi.
Okay, so basically we need to do some grant research.
I mean, this is what I mean. This is something that is, the reimbursement issue is something that's a whole lot bigger than me or than this particular program.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. I have a couple housekeeping announcements. The next session will begin at 11 a.m. Please refer to pages 28 and 29 of your agenda books to identify and locate the session you want to attend. The second immunization Q&A session will take place in the Regency 6, I think, this room, during the lunch break today, beginning at 12:30. Lunch will not be provided. Please feel free to bring your lunch with you. Please see page 7 in your agenda book for more information about the immunization Q&A session. The next hour of the conference is dedicated to poster and exhibit viewing. You will find light refreshments in the exhibit area. Thank you.